The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
We all, I'm sure, respect the dedication and hard work of the people at Haymarket, but I never really realized until this last spring quite how far-sighted they were when they republished two books by Victor Serge with Revolution in their title, which they carefully timed to be available for us to read during the Arab Spring and the events in Greece. It's hard to imagine a better occasion to introduce people to one of the great authors in the international socialist tradition, especially right now, a better time than right now with, as our conference says, revolution in the air. I'm not going to assume any familiarity with Serge, and so let me make that introduction now without delay in a single, albeit gnarly, sentence. Victor Serge was a Russian revolutionary writing in French who was born in Belgium and died in Mexico after doing time as an accomplice to armed robbery, supporting an abortive uprising in Spain, fighting in Trotsky's Red Army to defend Petrograd, helping translate Lenin's collected works, and discussing the theory of state capitalism with fellow Marxist prisoners of Stalin. Though he was released, thanks to an international campaign by prominent intellectuals, just in time to avoid being a defendant, and certainly dying, in the Moscow trials, only to have to flee Hitler, and all the while writing the greatest books you may never have heard of. As the title of my talk indicates, Serge was among the anarchists whose political outlook was profoundly transformed by the events of 1917. Very few of his comrades died a natural death, and indeed there's some question of whether Serge himself did. He was very poor and in bad health. He got into a taxi, and by the time that it reached his destination, he was dead. And there has been some speculation that he might have been yet another of the victims of the GPU. He might have been poisoned or something like that. It's not clear. It wouldn't be terribly shocking if that had happened. But he lived until 1947 and produced an extraordinary body of work: fiction, memoirs, history, pamphlets, literary journalism, political analysis, and poetry that captures the emancipatory spirit of the October Revolution, preserving some spark of it as the totalitarian night began to fall. Now, it may not mean very much to you, young Bolsheviks, to hear this, but Serge's importance as an author is increasingly recognized by even the most non-radical and apolitical of American petty bourgeois literatures. My Kindle will work here. I will know what I had to say next. A few years back, the paperback publishing arm of the New York Review of Books began reissuing Serge's novels, beginning with The Case of Comrade Tuliev, which, like a number of them, are at the back of the room. This is simply the great work of fiction on the Moscow trials of 1936 to 1938, a book far more substantial than Arthur Koestler's, and here in my original notes I had Turn and Spit, but it seems like a bad idea. Far more substantial than Arthur Koestler's vastly better-known novel, Darkness at Noon. Besides being more astute about the dynamics of Stalin's counter-revolution, Serge's imagination is broader and deeper in its capacity to honor the complex range of human experience amidst even the most nightmarishly repressive of systems. Instead, it has been the novel of Koestler, the Cold Warrior, that has shaped how generations of readers understood Stalinism. But then, as someone once said, the dominant ideas of an age are those of the ruling class. In any case, two more of Serge's novels have been available, been made available by New York Review of Books Press, which this fall will also be reissuing his Memoirs of a Revolutionary. Someone once said that you knew you'd read a great work of poetry because it made the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And by that standard, I will say that although it is certainly a work of prose, the Memoirs of Victor Serge, Memoirs of a Revolutionary, is absolutely a work of poetry by that definition. Now, at one level, we should be happy that Serge's artistry is being recognized if it means that his works are being made available. Yet this acceptance has come at a price. Before her death in 2004, Susan Sontag wrote an essay that appears as the introduction to the reissue of Comrade Tuliev, in which she celebrated Victor Serge as, quote, one of the most compelling of 20th century ethical and literary heroes, end quote. Now, he is certainly that, but here the word political is conspicuous in its absence and by no accident. The terms of his acceptance are that Serge the Marxist must make way for Serge the angel of literature and moral purity. His commitment to socialism is treated as a mere biographical detail, or even as implicit evidence of socialism's impossibility. Ah, he was so naive that he believed that the revolution would free anyone. Let's not mince words. Victor Serge was a revolutionary right down to his cells, almost literally so, revolutionary by birthright, as we'll talk to about in just a second. He was born in exile and poverty. He died in exile and poverty. And every word he published, so far as I can tell, every day he lived even, was driven by no other goal than the absolute destruction of exploitation and tyranny and the creation of a society in which, to borrow another formulation from Marx, the full development of all requires the full development of each. Viktor Lvovich Kapalchich, I meant to ask Jason to explain how to pronounce this before the session. As he was named at birth, Viktor Serge was a pen name he adopted in 1917, was the son of Russian intellectuals who, like many of their generation, supported the egalitarian anti-government movement known as the Narodniks. They emigrated during the wave of repression that came after a Narodnik bomb killed the Tsar in 1881. And in his memoirs, Serge gives a really vivid account of his family's circumstances during the final decade of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. And this will be the first of three somewhat lengthy passages I'm going to quote. I was born in Brussels, as it happened, in mid-journey across the world, because my parents, in quest of their daily bread and of good libraries, were commuting between London, the British Museum, Paris, Switzerland, and Belgium. On the walls of our humble and makeshift lodgings, there were always the portraits of men who had been hanged. The conversations of grown-ups dealt with trials, executions, escapes, and Siberian highways, with great ideas incessantly argued over, and with the latest books about those ideas. I learned to read from cheap editions of Shakespeare and Chekhov, and, dozing off to sleep, I dreamt for hours of blind King Lear, leaning in his journey across the cruel wasteland on the tender attentions of Cordelia. I also acquired bitter experience of that unwritten commandment, "Thou shalt be hungry." I think that if anyone had asked me at the age of 12, what is life, and I often asked it of myself, I would have replied, I do not know, but I think I can see that it means, thou shalt think, thou shalt struggle, thou shalt be hungry. Now, if at this point you feel no interest in reading Serge's memoirs, you are probably at the wrong event. You're probably at the wrong conference. As a teenager, Serge went to work as a photographer's assistant, later working as a printer and also picking up money as a kind of a freelance translator. He joined the youth group of the Belgian Socialist Party, but found the tepid reformism of mainstream social democracy disagreeable, particularly the electoralism, you know, the, oh, we got 14 new candidates, and 14 new candidates were elected to the parliament. That sort of thing just was not what Serge was about. Settling in Paris in 1909, he was drawn to the anarchists, lived in their communes, and wrote and spoke for the movement. And there were communes, there were vegetarianism. If any of you folks are working back home with people in the nonviolent anarcho-syndicalist dumpster-diving hip-hop collective, then Serge was doing it a century earlier. So there's hope for those comrades yet. We can win them to something better. In any case, this strand of anarchism that he was recruited to at that time was very individualistic. A high degree of disdain for people who did not fight against the system, for workers who merely wanted more wages and better working conditions, but were not prepared to destroy bourgeois society. There was a definite air of arrogance in Serge's writings during this period, but he's like 19 and 20 years old, and so you can't judge much of what happened after that based on those early writings. In this milieu, there were people who took their hatred of bourgeois society to the next perhaps logical step of robbing its banks. Serge privately expressed serious misgivings about that sort of thing, and there are these letters where he says, you know, every time somebody is a pickpocket or a burglar or whatever, he gets arrested and he goes up in court, he says, I'm doing it to vive l'anarchie, you know, and this was not looking good for us. You know, it's becoming kind of cheap. But he published articles defending this group of people who had been doing the bank robbing called the Bonneau Gang. And he was tried and convicted as an accomplice. He was not involved in the bank robberies themselves, but he simply defended them in print. He was tried and convicted as an accomplice and spent 1912 to 1917 in prison. He easily could have changed his mind. He easily could have written something just saying, you know, actually saying in public what he was thinking, telling his other comrades. But there's this very firm kind of moral line that is drawn there with him. Upon release, he soon moved to Barcelona to connect with a group of Spanish anarcho-syndicalists. Revolution was in the air, but the uprising that he was involved with there failed. Meanwhile, the World War ground on and on, with the only real glimmer of hope being events in Russia. A minute clarity was shed over things, Serge later wrote. The world was no longer impelled along by helpless lunacy. As with just about everybody else outside Russia, Serge at that time knew very little at all about the Bolsheviks. But there were, and he has a sense that I have to get to Russia. I have to join in what's going on. And it takes him a solid 18 months to get there. He's detained, he's put in jails, and so on and so forth. And along the way, he's picking up little bits and pieces of an understanding of Bolshevism. The first thing he's struck by is the role of the state in Bolshevik thought, which is the attempt to abolish it. This is absolutely not taken for granted in the mainstream social democratic movement at the time. The idea is sort of, you know, the state takes over more and more kind of services and function and property, and we can sort of get there incrementally that way. The idea that ultimately the state is an armed body of people there in order to maintain an exploitive order, and therefore once exploitation is abolished, then the state will go. That is an almost anarchist idea. And it appeals to Serge. He's also very conscious of the need to defend the revolution. When he gets to Petrograd, it's at a moment in the Civil War when there's a very great danger of Petrograd, one of the birthplaces of the revolution, being overtaken by the White Army, the counter-revolutionaries. And the anarchists sort of had the idea, well, you abolish the state and power is gone, and it'll all be good at that point. And he can clearly see that whatever the alternative, that is not an alternative, basically. And then finally, he has a sense of the value of a revolutionary organization, the value of a party. In Petrograd, he sees that workers are, by and large, in the Bolshevik Party. The image he often uses for the party is that of the nervous system. Really great books, From Lenin to Stalin, he has an account of the, I guess you would say, the ethos of the Bolshevik Party in those early years that can't be beat. I've just never read anything else that's quite this good. So this will, there you go. He's describing the leaders. And of course, at the time, you have the cult of Stalin is becoming more and more like a mob, the notion that is what a revolutionary movement is supposed to look like. He makes a great point that Lenin, people are not afraid to challenge Lenin during those periods. It's just, you know, Lenin is a first among equals, but there are hard-fought battles, there are hard debates over this. And so there's none of this cult of the leader. That kicks in after Lenin's death. He says, the leader's popularity was not manufactured nor imposed. It grew up spontaneously on the basis of the confidence they earned. Their actions and their words were discussed everywhere, and more than that, they answered their enemies with a shrug of the shoulders. To the workers, they explained their position and sometimes found themselves outvoted. They were only the first among comrades, and they would have accorded a cold reception to the dangerous imbecile who took it into his head to place them above their comrades or above the party. No one thought of fighting for a totalitarian state. Men fought and died for a new kind of freedom. Bolshevism triumphed by proclaiming to the masses and to the world a democracy of free workers such as had never been before seen. The first Soviet constitution, drawn up by Sverdlov, guaranteed every liberty to the toilers. No one, for example, thought of abolishing the freedom of the press the day after the victorious insurrection. The Bolsheviks' aim was to make the monopoly of to take the monopoly of the press from the bourgeoisie. With this end in view, it was necessary to suppress the reactionary press, which moreover specialized in campaigns of slander. But, said Trotsky, every group of citizens should have printing presses and paper at their disposal. And Lenin put forth a proposal that every group of citizens supported by 10 to 15,000 toilers should have the right to issue a paper if it wished. Now, obviously, this situation did not last, and it is the burden of Serge's work to deny Stalinism any claim to continuity with the Bolshevism of the revolution. To talk about that and Serge's kind of rolling assessment of what happened, what went wrong, is something I'll get to. But first, I have to do sort of a quick sketch of what I hesitate to call Serge's career as a Bolshevik. And I hesitate for that because he's absolutely not a careerist. Okay, that's the most striking thing, and he's very conscious of other people who are joining the party at just that time with that very much in mind. It's like, okay, I'll get my party card, and then I'll get a nice apartment, and so on and so forth. Serge is almost an ascetic. He joins the party shortly after arriving in Russia in 1919. In due course, he's assigned to work on the administrative staff of the Communist International. This is where his fluency with languages was extremely helpful. And he served on the Comintern in the offices for its first three congresses. And in his memoirs, there are just wonderful accounts of these congresses in which he describes the people who come to them. And some of them will be known to some of you through your studies. Georg Lukács is there. Antonio Gramsci is the guy down the hall whose manuscript is coming in. And others, Andre Amin and Amadio Bordiga, a little bit less known. He's at heart an artist, a novelist, and these are incredibly vivid passages, descriptions, anecdotes of these folks. He was sent to Germany to do press work, and that is the material in Witness to the German Revolution, which is, I think, almost literally hot off the press from Haymarket. He reports on the developments in Germany in 1923. It's great sort of on-the-spot history. It's also, I really kind of wish we had a workshop at this conference on using that book as an introduction to revolutionary journalism, to socialist journalism. It's a very good model. I recommend people check it out. The failure of the German Revolution, which is a subject for another day, another meeting, or two or three, brings to the definite close a whole period of the revolutionary experience. At that point, Stalin's policy of socialism in one country, this idea that basically we can really count, we must count on the world revolution to make progress towards socialism possible, is thrown out the window. This utterly ridiculous notion of socialism in one country is dredged up. And Serge, who up to this point has been feeling a lot of disquiet, but he hasn't, as far as we can tell from his writings, he seems not to have gone into print with very much about this. But at this point, he joins the left opposition. And in the memoirs, there are accounts of what the struggle of the left opposition was like, the effort to go around to you know, party branches and get a hearing, simply get a hearing for Trotsky's ideas, and being shouted down, having to work in an almost underground kind of clandestine fashion. These again are riveting passages in this autobiography. The left opposition is defeated. He undergoes a period of internal emigration where he's not in prison yet, but he's confined to certain areas. And then in the early 1930s, there's even more severe repression. He's put into solitary confinement for like a long time, at least a few months. And he's only finally released in 1936. Because he has a reputation among French readers. He's written for the French Communist literary cult magazine for a while. He's known to people. And at this time, 1936, Soviet Union is trying very hard to develop a friendly diplomatic relationship with France as the war, as the clouds of war are coming over the continent. And eventually, this may be the only thing in the 1930s that Trotskyists do that's worth talking about in France. I mean, because they spent a lot of time just like throwing spitballs at each other, but they do launch this campaign. They work with this campaign. The teachers' union is heavily involved in it, and it succeeds. It gets him out. It gets him out. As a matter of fact, just months, bare months before he certainly would have ended up rounded up in the beginning of the Moscow trials. Now, before his release, his papers are Thanks. His papers, his manuscripts were confiscated by the secret police. His mail had been confiscated for quite a while. He would write a book and try to send it to France, and they go, oh, well, I don't know. I can't find it. And so somewhere in the archive, the people have been trying to find this for 20 years now. There is, he wrote a great book, published a great book called Year One of the Russian Revolution. He'd gone on to write Year Two of the Russian Revolution. That's somewhere in Moscow, presumably in a folder someplace. He'd written a couple of novels. He wrote a book of poetry, which was the only one thing he was able to reconstitute afterwards. Once he was released, he was able to remember the poems. He had a lot of time while in prison to write them and get to know them very well. So he was able to reconstruct that. But quite a bit of his work during that period is lost. Now, before going forward, I need to backtrack a little bit to the year 1928, which aside from being the defeat of the left opposition, is also for Serge, as it turns out, a really significant hinge year. He becomes an anarchist revolutionary in 1909. So 1928 means it's been, at that point, 19 years. And he lives another 19 years. Okay, he dies in 1947. So this, just as it happens, is the dead middle of his career as a revolutionary. And I didn't mean that pun to come out, but dead middle is actually just about right, because during this period, he gets very, very sick. He's at death's door. It's definitely one of those cases where he could just as well have died as not. And he has a sense during his lucid moments of this, I've never written what I really know. I've never written what I really understand. Our generation, which made this revolution, some of them are still alive. The secret police aren't taking the old Bolsheviks into cellars and shooting them yet. But the memory is going to go. The memory is going to die. And so I have to, he has a sense of a calling, that this is his thing in the world to do. The party, as a common expression goes, the party is the memory of the class. Serge has the sense of being the memory of the party at this point. And he understands the role of revolutionary to include what he calls the double duty. One is to defend the revolution from forces outside which are trying to destroy it. The other is to defend the revolution from tendencies, from forces within that tend to destroy it. Now, as a footnote here, I mentioned that Serge translated Lenin, whose style was always exceptionally direct, vigorous, and task-oriented. And in a later comment, Serge makes a remark which is not disparaging at all. It's actually very admiring of this quality. But he says of Lenin, never in his life did he make the slightest concession to the demon of literature. Now, if I had to do it all over again, that would be the title of this talk. Victor Serge on the Demon of Literature. Because the man threw himself into writing with all the energy a demon may be assumed to give you. And his great gifts as a writer, aside from the capacity to turn a phrase until it's just polished beautifully, but spontaneously, there's no affectation to it at all, is he has considerable gifts in narrative, and portraiture of living people, and in creating fictional characters, not just individual fictional characters, but sort of constellations of them, so that you're able to see a social phenomenon, an event, a moment, from multiple perspectives in that. John McDonald from Haymarket was talking about reading The Conquered City, which is the most recently republished of his novels, which is in some ways a kind of the fictional companion to Revolution in Danger. And he said, you know, I've never read anything that where you really get a sense of a whole class thinking in a crisis situation, the working class of Petrograd. In the case of Comrade Tuliev, his great novel about the Moscow trials, everyone from like the little old lady down the hall who lives next to the person who's arrested by the GPU in the middle of the night, through a character who's obviously Stalin, something called the leader, is portrayed in such a profoundly sympathetic way that this man who suffered at Stalin's hands is able to get inside the head of the paranoia that has to be there. Okay? And this is just a remarkable capacity. Now Serge is not a theorist. Okay, he's not a Marxist theorist. He makes no pretensions to being one. He is absolutely not a strategist, and yet he has, in his years of exile, to try to come up with some account of what went wrong, what defending the revolution from within. involves doing a sort of a post-mortem on it at this point in order to pass the lessons along to the next generation. But he doesn't have the virtue. There's apparently a French expression that goes, he had the virtue, he had the vices of his virtue. Okay, his virtue is the ability to be very concrete, to be very direct and candid. He did not have the virtue of being able to come up with a systematic analysis. Okay, and so he borrows bits and pieces, certainly, from Lenin and Trotsky on this. Lenin, during his final year, 1922 to 23, is very clear that something that we do not have a worker state. He says we have a worker state with bureaucratic deformations, and a very great consciousness of all these people, these careerists who are moving into the government and the party. Can we say that we control the apparatus of the state? And we really can't. He's definitely marked by that. He's also influenced by Trotsky's opposition, obviously, and dedicates him to that without ever being a hero worshiper of Trotsky, really. He says at a certain point when he writes about the prisoners from the left opposition, we respected Trotsky a great deal, but it was not a matter of simply agreeing with everything that the man said. He tries to develop his own set of ideas about what went wrong. And they cover a lot of ground. And I'll just hit the three main ones very quickly. The first is the new economic policy introduced in 1921, which revives a certain amount of capitalism, of trade within the Soviet Union the Soviet system. And reintroduces inequality in a big way. Okay, there's an opposition called the Workers' Opposition that is very much opposed to this. And Serge later says, "Well, I sort of agree with some of the Workers' Opposition principles on this." The rebellion at Kronstadt in early 1921, when disgruntled soldiers with very direct ties to the countryside. Attempt basically to throw the Bolsheviks out of power in the local government, and they're meanwhile being manipulated like crazy by the whites abroad, by the counter-revolutionaries abroad, and the Bolsheviks repress this uprising. Serge is definitely of two minds about this. At one point he writes, the revolution has always been threatened, and it has a right to defend itself even against those who, with the best intentions. Are posing a danger to it. At the same time, he thinks, gee, did we have to take as stern a measures as we did? Could we not have worked out something? Could we not have negotiated with them? There's his sense of the Cheka, the anti-counter-revolutionary police that emerges in 1918. Which is actually fairly mild in its repression of counter-revolution for the first half of 1918. Then, as the Civil War begins, they kick into overdrive, and there's a great deal of liquidation of opponents without trial. And he thinks, well, maybe that was it. Maybe that's when we got it wrong. Now, the problem with this is that some of these things don't really go together, okay? If you support the workers' opposition, the workers' opposition people were fighting the Kronstadt people. Okay, so there's a little bit of incompatibility here. There was no sympathy lost between the Kronstadt people and the Workers' Opposition people. Okay, he's on the Cheka. It's a little bit different. He is not. And some people sort of do the shaking their finger at him, going, "Well, you have to defend the revolution." He knows that, but he is concerned that having repressive power that is completely unregulated, in which there is no basic accountability except to the local party, which pretty much is going to go, all right, check it off. You did what you had to do. That was a bad dynamic, a dangerous dynamic. Now, after he gets out of Russia in 1936, Serge begins to work, naturally enough, with Trotsky, and becomes Trotsky's kind of authorized translator. At a certain point, Trotsky says, "Don't even bother sending me your translation. I know it's going to be good. I know it'll be fine. Just go forward with it." Serge contributes to Trotsky's work on the book The Revolution Betrayed. He writes his own sort of companion volume to that called The Destiny of a Revolution. And there's a period of time there when it's very good working relationship. However, Serge is not quite so enamored of the Trotskyists that he meets in Europe. And he says about the French I've already mentioned, the spitballs, splitting over stuff that nobody really can explain now. But he says, and at one point he says, he writes to Trotsky about the Belgian Trotskyists, "I know very little about their activity, but their clannishness, with its morbid psychology, makes a dismal impression on me." Trotsky at this time is attempting to create the Fourth International, okay, to rally his forces together to prepare for the World War, which everyone knows is coming, to be prepared as the Bolsheviks were lead the revolution after the war. And Serge, who has just been in prison with the best of the comrades of the left opposition, looks around and just thinks, "I don't know what we're going to do, but this is not it." He doesn't really write for the Trotskyist press very much. However, he does, because he has buddies in the anarcho-syndicalist movement and people in Spain and so on. He writes for their press. Trotsky does not take this well. 1937 is the worst of the Moscow trials. He's extremely defensive, and it goes from the most amiable of working relationships to something incredibly unhappy. Okay, there's a volume called The Serge Trotsky Papers, which is now out of print, which is outrageously expensive. I hope the folks at Haymarket will consider reissuing it. But Trotsky perhaps becomes convinced that Serge is simply a moralist. He's sort of a literary dilettante and so on. This is very unworthy of Trotsky. I mean, this is a man who had fought for the movement, who had done his time in jail, Trotsky felt in a state of siege. And so there's this kind of parting of ways at that point. Now, I am simply setting some of this up because I know some of you know so much about Kronstadt, and you know the workers' opposition and all the rest of it. I'm going to let you debate that. And I'm going to simply say that keeping in mind that Serge makes no pretenses to be a systematic thinker, how then do we understand what his role was? And it seems to me that the word witness, which I'd forgotten actually was in the title of the book on the German Revolution, the word witness is extremely useful. And not simply in the sense of somebody who was an observer, somebody who was there and can tell you, well, this happened and this happened. And at this point, I'm definitely going to get into some murky waters here, but there's almost a religious sense of witness here. And I'm not saying by any means that there's any kind of religious sentiment to Serge, but almost in the kind of evangelical Christian sense that I know of a truth, it has changed me, and it is my responsibility to be a witness to that, even if the world is against me. Now, he was witness to the revolution, to 1917, to the potential of that moment. And however you assess his critique of what came afterwards, his capacity to do that is simply unparalleled. And so I'll simply end with a thought, and here's murkier water still. There's a French philosopher named Alain Badiou, who's any nods of recognition? I kind of thought so. Who, among many another perplexing idea, has this concept of the event, which is something that happens, not simply a political event, not simply, you know, some celebrity does something and the media cover it, but an event is a moment in politics and science or something in which the terms fundamentally change. Something new seems to come into the world that had not existed before, and it changes the dynamics of things, changes the possibility, a human possibility. And Badiou has this concept of fidelity to the event. Now, my relationship with Badiou is certainly quizzical at best, but this has seemed to resonate in thinking about Serge. And on that point, I want to end with the third and final passage from the memoirs, an earlier edition of which is available in the back, which I reread every so often. "What will become of us in 20 years' time?" we asked ourselves one evening. He's remembering about being a young kind of bohemian radical in Paris. He's saying, "What will become of us in 20 years' time?" we asked ourselves one evening. 30 years have passed now. Raymond was guillotined. Anarchist gangster, so the headline said. It was he who, walking towards the worthy Dr. Guillotine's disgusting machine, flung a last sarcasm at the reporters. Nice to see a man die, eh? I came across Jean again in Brussels, a worker and a trade union organizer, still a fighter for liberty after 10 years in jail. Luce has died of tuberculosis naturally. For my part, I've undergone a little over 10 years of various forms of captivity, agitated in 7 countries, and written 20 books. I own nothing. On several occasions, a press with a vast circulation has hurled filth at me because I spoke the truth. Behind us lies a victorious revolution gone astray, several abortive attempts at revolution, and massacres in so great a number as to inspire a certain dizziness. And to think that it is not yet over. Let me be done with this digression. Those were the only roads possible for us. I have more confidence in mankind and in the future than ever before. So that's what you get when you read Victor Serge.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.